Our organization is all volunteer, other than two key subcontractor positions that we issue a 1099 to each year. Recently, one of our new board members shared concerns about having our subcontractors listed on our website with titles such as finance coordinator and director of community partnerships. I didn't want to seem ignorant as the board chair, so I mentioned that we'd look into it, and then I moved us along to another topic. Is there a problem with the way we're handling titles of subcontractors?
I want to applaud you for moving on to another topic. I think that's the perfect answer to that kind of a question.
Without saying I have no freaking clue or I don't know exactly what the answer is. Good for you. That means you are a great board chair.
Exactly. I hope the segue was super random too. Like, is it warm in here? Anyway, moving on to the next item, right? Stacey, I think we're going to need a guest expert on this one to like give us the official rules, because what this delves into is sort of like worker misclassification.
Right.
So one of the things that, you know, the fact that they're subcontractors is already questionable because it sounds like they're sort of long-term employees, and I suspect they're being given tasks by someone and they're not working totally independently, which is what a subcontractor is really supposed to do. So IRS gets super jumpy. So does the EEOC get super jumpy about making somebody a subcontractor when they're really an employee, because what you're doing is you're sort of avoiding employer taxes and forcing it onto somebody else. They don't really like that. But then the question about, is the title the issue? I don't know that the title is the issue, but I don't think I've ever heard anything one way or the other on this one. Have you?
No. I was thinking about a lot of people I know get creative with different titles, or maybe they're trying to make their organization seem bigger than it is. Mm-hmm. So they take someone who's a subcontractor and slap on a title and put it on their website, which is sort of what this might be, right? It's an all-volunteer organization, sort of trying to show legitimacy. And I sense that that's probably what's happening here. And what I just don't know is, does it really matter what the title is, or is it more about what all the rules that come with, you know, differences between employees and independent contractors, right? Is that really where the crux is? And you can call someone whatever the heck you want to call them, and you can put them on your website and you can market them as that. Who cares, as long as like the contract with that person is truly a independent relationship and not an employee. So I think a guest expert sounds great. Let's see who we can find.
Nonprofit governance.
Nonprofit answers.
Nonprofit board.
Nonprofit management.
Nonprofit marketing.
Nonprofit resources.
Welcome to Nonprofit Everything, the podcast where hosts Andy Shurick and Stacey Wedding answer your questions about all things nonprofit.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Nonprofit Everything. This is Stacey Wedding, and I am here with special guest Gina Bon Jovi. Welcome, Gina.
Hi, Stacey. Thanks for having me.
So glad to have you. Gina's been on in the past. We love Gina. She's like, you know, no offense and disrespect to our attorney friends out there, but she's one of like the cool ones, right? That you could have a conversation with and not feel intimidated and scared by. So super appreciate it when Gina's willing to share her expertise. A little bit of background, and I'll let her jump in if she's got anything to add. But Gina's the managing partner at Bon Jovi Law Firm, has been in business since 2008. So 16 years, if my math button is correct, right? 16?
Yeah. Coming up on 16.
Wow. That's crazy, right? Oh my gosh. I was like, you're like ready to drive. You're like a teenager in driving mode. So
I know my law firm's a teenager.
Gina's also a native Las Vegan. She works only, one of the things I love about her firm is she works with small businesses and nonprofits as their outside general counsel. And so I can say I have actually had to utilize Gina's services in the past, and she's amazing and such a wealth of knowledge and support for those of us just trying to figure it out. She and I both are UNLV Honors College alum and serve on the advisory board together. So, she is, if you could see her, she like raised her UNLV cup because she's in the UNLV spirit. I have a UNLV thing here too, Gina. I'll have to show it at some point just for your giggles. But anyways, with that said, Gina, anything else you want to add? for our listeners?
No, I mean, I think the only part of that introduction that's notable is that I started a practice serving small businesses in 2008 in Las Vegas, which was one of the, you know, arguably the hardest hit communities and the hardest hit demographic, under the theory, I guess, that there's nowhere to go from there but up. And so we continue to work with, like you said, small businesses and nonprofits, and we love it. It's yeah. great working with inspired, creative people and trying to keep them out of trouble.
Yes, because we all, sometimes the more innovative we are, the more trouble we can get ourselves into. So yes, anyways, well, cool. Glad to have you here. So we're going to just dive into the question and use that big brain of yours. Our organization is all volunteer, other than two key subcontractor positions that we issue a 1099 to each year. Recently, one of our new board members shared concerns about having our subcontractors listed on our website with titles such as finance coordinator and director of community partnerships. I didn't want to seem ignorant as the board chair, so I mentioned that we would look into it. And then I moved us to another topic. Is there a problem with the way we are handling titles of subcontractors?
I love that. Just hurry, quick, change the subject.
Yes. Let's just, let's put a pin in that, right? For another time.
Moving on to the next agenda item. So employee, they call it kind of generally employee or worker misclassification. Which is an issue that has implications on both the state and federal level. And this goes for both small businesses and nonprofits. And remember, a nonprofit is a tax tab, it's not a business plan. So they're, you know, they should be run like businesses. So from the frustrating part about this is that the IRS alone has either three or four different tests for whether you can treat a worker as an independent contractor, properly as an independent contractor. One is a 5-part test, one's a 12-part test, one's a 25-part test. You can ask for an advanced ruling. The state of Nevada keeps changing their the ways they view independent contractors and the way you can get away with it. And what it used to be, and there is talk of the Biden administration changing that and making it even more difficult to classify somebody properly as an independent contractor. It's almost impossible to classify somebody as an independent contractor in California. So with that landscape in mind, with that treacherous landscape in mind, let's talk a little bit about the way you, or the way I kind of go about this analysis. So it used to be, historically, it was the amount of control that you exert over the worker, so I'm going to call them a worker just generically, used to dictate. And it's kind of like I went to a presentation by an employment lawyer who talked about like a needle. So if you think of, you know, your speedometer in your car, and the needle goes kind of in the direction of an independent contractor or an employee. So if you want to keep that in your head as a visual, previously, the amount of control that you exerted over the worker, the more control you exerted over that worker, the more it would nudge the needle in favor of you needing to treat them as an employee. And some examples of control are giving them a schedule, giving them a uniform, giving them the tools that they need to complete the job. And in modern times, that has also kind of extended to, do you have an @bonjovilaw.com email address? Are you featured on the company's website? Are you given titles that are typically held by employees? And then and it's very tempting to just classify everybody as an independent contractor because it's an easier relationship. You're not paying the payroll taxes and getting into all of the employment kind of complexities when you do have employees. In this particular example that you just cited, I would have some concerns about those people with those titles being paid as independent contractors. And one of the things, at least from the state of Nevada's perspective, what the state of Nevada looks at is a couple of things, and I've actually sat in hearings with auditors from the labor commissioner who have shared the factors they look at in determining whether a company is in violation of this law. So the way you kind of build a case or build a scenario in which you can properly classify someone as an independent contractor is ideally they have their own entity, like LLC or corporation. They have their own business licenses. They're offering those same services to other people. They're not exclusive to you. They are independent from your control. You aren't giving them any tools, a computer, anything like that. And the third factor that really kind of kicks people out of it and moves that needle kind of violently back in the direction of classifying someone as an employee is the type of services they're providing you. If the type of services that they're rendering for your company or your organization are part and parcel of what that organization does, then they should be classified as an employee. So the good example of that is it is almost impossible for me as a law firm to hire a paralegal and properly classify them as an independent contractor, because the services of a paralegal are part and parcel of what a law firm does. Now, if I were to hire a website designer, that is not, those services are not part and parcel of what a law firm offers. And so I could legitimately pay that person as an independent contractor. Would I still want to have an independent contractor agreement with them? Would I still want them to have their own business license? Would I still want it to be abundantly clear they're not exclusive to me? Yes, yes, yes. So I think those concerns in that example you cited are real and things that should be considered moving forward for that organization so that they don't get crosswise with those types of things. The other thing I have seen is workers will go into a relationship willing to be, and sometimes even requesting to be paid as an independent contractor, knowing full well that they should be classified as an employee. And when the relationship sours for some reason and that worker leaves, they turn around and file a wage claim with the labor commissioner. And then it opens a whole new can of worms for the organization. Ooh. Because it's sort of like weaponizing the statutes and the law. Ooh. Against the employer. So there's, it's funny too, because I used to deal with like a lot of wage claims, and some of them are just completely fraudulent wage claims. And when you have the proof, and it's just a lot of work to put all of the things, put your case together. But what I was finding is that with those fraudulent wage claims, like I had one client and she had like four or five of them from prior employees. And I said, are these people like talking to each other? And I thought there was some sort of like underground communication network where people were teaching each other how to really screw over their former employers. Right.
Yeah.
And I mentioned that to somebody more recently. So I think I made that comment originally, maybe like 8 or 10 years ago. And then more recently I made that comment and they said, yeah, it's not so much underground. It's called TikTok. That there are accounts where people are teaching people how to weaponize the system and really leverage it for their own benefit. So it is a very dangerous thing to misclassify your employees. Again, there are ramifications on the state and federal level. I do have a blog on my website that talks about DETR. It's DETR audit, which is the Department of Employment Training and Rehabilitation, at least here in the state of Nevada, kind of goes through what they look for in this classification thing. That was very long-winded, but it is an area rich with pitfalls.
Oh, well, and I have follow-up questions, my friend, but yeah, that's my head is spinning and I'm cringing a little all at the same time, because I think we all know there are probably a lot of organizations, you know, both, and this isn't just a nonprofit thing, right? For-profit, yeah. Nonprofit, but in this particular case, a nonprofit organization that potentially has a misclassification issue. And can you speak a little bit to what is the penalty? So how would someone find out if someone is misclassified, other than that outright outrageous example you just shared? Mm-hmm. How would someone find it out? And then can you talk about the liability and risk to the organization, to its board members, to those two employees or you know, people that are classified as subcontractors that should be employees?
Sure. So I love my horror stories and real life examples of clients that I've represented in the past. And of course, no names will be shared to protect the innocent or not so innocent. But I had a client some years ago that had a pool maintenance and repair business. And he called me one day and he had gotten a letter from the Department of Employment Training and Rehabilitation, which is Nevada's kind of employee protection agency. And they wanted to conduct an audit on his books, which seemed innocuous at first. And among the bulleted list of items that they wanted to see was a report of his 1099 contractors. And so in my view, these DETR audits are really just a pretense to figure out who these 1099 contractors are. It's really to figure out whether somebody is misclassifying their employees. They don't really care how much revenue you made. They don't really care what your, you know, sales tax was. It's really to get at the heart of who your 1099 contractors are. So I'm sitting in my office. I conducted the hearing at my office so that the employee's record or the company's records were not readily accessible, with an auditor from Dieter who was, no joke, a moonlighting stand-up comedian.
Oh.
I have never faked laughed so many times in my life that to try to keep making this guy think that I thought he was.
You're
hilarious.
Making friendly to try to, yeah.
I'm trying. Oh my gosh. So what ended up happening was he looked at the QuickBooks report. There was a 1099 contractor line item. He said, I want to see all the reports on that. And there were probably 60 or 70 names of people that this pool maintenance and repair business had paid as 1099 contractors. What the client revealed, not to me prior to the meeting, but at the meeting with the auditor, was that he would get a series of work orders from his customers in the morning. I need my filter replaced, my motor's out of my spa, whatever it is. And then he would take those work orders. He would go to his nearest Home Depot. He would pick up day laborers. He would drop them off at the job sites with their instructions, pick them up at the end of the day, pay them cash, and drop them back off at Home Depot. I'm, of course, horrified when this is coming out of his mouth, and I'm kicking him under the table. But the fact of the matter is that those people should have been paid as employees because they are conducting pool maintenance and repair. And then when the auditor said them, the next words out of my client's mouth, I've never been more horrified in my life, were, well, I'm not even sure if they're legal to work in the United States. I'm going to need you to shut up, please. So with all of that being said, the auditor, you know, did his calculations and figured that, you know, he could go back now 3 years and investigate. Once they find, you know, a discrepancy of, I think it's 5%, they can blow up they can expand the scope of the audit to 3 years. And so there were probably, I'd say all in 100 or so contractors that he had paid, variation thing or whatever. And I'm watching this guy, and it was almost like the Looney Tunes cartoon with the calculator with the tape that's like the paper that's flying out of the old school calculator. And then he arrives at an amount for a fine that was like $5,000, which I thought it was going to have another zero at the end of it.
Yeah,
to be honest,
absolutely.
And I looked at the client, I was like, you need to whip out your checkbook right now, pay that fine, and we need to get your act together moving forward.
Yes.
So at least from a state level, now in no way am I saying, hey, the penalties are not that bad, so don't worry about it. In that instance, they were not as bad as I thought they were going to be. Now, there are other implications on the federal level for misclassifying employees, because then you've got the IRS can get involved, you've got the Department of Labor that can get involved. And if they believe that, one of the other benefits of paying somebody as an independent contractor and why that is so tempting is because independent contractors don't enjoy the same rights that employees do. And so if you're paying somebody and you're considering someone an independent contractor and you're not meal breaks, wage and hour stuff, overtime, all of those things that you have to pay attention to when you have employees, if any sort of agency decides that you're misclassifying somebody and they should be an employee, and they find out that you have not afforded them the same protections that an employee would receive, then you're in even hotter water.
So is there a percent? So there's state and federal implications. At what level do you see it go federal? I mean, is that rare that it would get to federal?
Luckily, and I'm knocking on all the wood around me,
yes.
I haven't seen that particular thing go federal yet. I did have an issue with the Department of Labor where an employee insisted on being paid a salary, which is an exempt classification, meaning she's exempt from overtime.
Yes.
And so as such, being a salaried employee, she was not clocking in and clocking out. And she was taking very long lunches and she was coming in late and leaving early and doing all those things. And later she filed a complaint with the federal Department of Labor saying, my job description, because you can't just pay anybody a salary. You can't just make anybody an exempt employee. They have to fall into certain classifications based on their job duties. And so she, I mean, this was pretty dastardly. She manipulated the situation so that she was paid as an exempt employee, abused the freedoms that kind of come with salaried employee, where you're not clocking in and clocking out and things like that. And then she turned around and filed a complaint with the Department of Labor saying that her job duties did not qualify her to be paid as an exempt employee. And then she claimed that she had worked all sorts of overtime and was not paid for it. And of course, it's the employer's responsibility, both on a state and federal level, to keep track of time and hours and everything worked. And the employer didn't have any of those records because she insisted on being a salaried employee. So that was like a 4-day hearing that I flew up to Reno to help with. And I mean, so those are the types of things that have to be really careful about. So I've not seen yet in my career with my clients the employee classification thing go federal, but I have had probably a dozen audits at the state level for that.
So when you talked about the example you shared about the $5,000 fee as an example, so theoretically, so a nonprofit misclassifies, there's, you know, they get an audit, they find out that it was misclassified, they pay the penalties. Are there any other implications to the employee, the, you know, board members hopefully are covered with some type of D&O insurance? Would this ever come back to bite the board members? From thinking about it from a nonprofit perspective, is there anything else? I mean, it's bad enough to have that fee. Is there anything else they got to worry about too?
Well, I mean, so in that fee or those penalties that the Department of Employment Training and Rehabilitation would assess, it doesn't mean it's like a settlement and release of claims. So it doesn't shut the door for future claims or for that employee who was misclassified to turn around and file a wage claim and go to a different state agency to really kind of screw over the organization. I don't necessarily see there being individual liability on the officer or board member level. Although to anybody who serves as on a board, like make sure there's D&O insurance in place. Yes. I'm sure your audience is very familiar with that kind of stuff. Yes. Because normally the board members are not making those decisions. So they're not directly to blame for how somebody is going to be classified. Usually that's an executive director, CEO decision. It can be something that someone sends up a flare, like happened in this board meeting, like, hey, I'm not really sure this is proper. But I wouldn't go so far as to say if you did have the audit, you had the stand-up comedian, you laughed at all of those dumb jokes, and you had to pay $5,000, doesn't close the door on there being future issues. I also suspect that it kind of puts you on the map with that agency in particular so that they would maybe audit you again in the future. So you'd want to really pull your act together after that and bite the bullet. You know, it is a pain in the butt to put people on payroll. It's a pain in the butt to pay all the payroll taxes and deal with all that kind of stuff. And I never recommend any organization do its own payroll because it's so easy to screw up and the penalties are really high. I don't even do my own. So there are some costs involved in it, but it's well worth the avoidance of the liability.
Is it fair to say I could imagine that some of our listeners would say, hey, we're an all volunteer organization. And so, or we are tiny, we're teeny tiny, we're grassroots. So no one's going to come after us because we're not even like, you know, we're not really a big shark in the tank. So any response to that?
That may be true. And I have seen, whether it be, you know, local licensing bureaus like the city of Las Vegas, some years ago, they would choose certain categories of business licenses to go inspect, go make sure they have, you know, all of their permits and licenses they needed, if they had an office, if they had all of the, you know, proper things. And they chose the ones that were typically, like, they did choose pool maintenance and repair as a business license category to kind of go after and make sure, because it was more lucrative for licensing fees and penalties and things like that. So I understand you may not be a big target. You may not have deep pockets, but you're not a target. And unfortunately, that's kind of the heartbreaking thing about being a small volunteer. Now, if you're volunteer run, that's a different thing, because if people are not getting paid, they're not getting paid. They're volunteers. But if you are paying people, that's when it starts to get a little sketchy. And there's, you know, you may be a gigantic organization, you may be the teeniest, tiniest organization with, you know, a husband and wife as the volunteers that are running an animal rescue out of their spare bedroom, and you could still be the target.
Okay. That's important to know. And one other thing that sort of flagged my attention when you were talking was you talked about tools. If you give if you give a subcontractor tools that normally like an employee would have, and you mentioned computers and stuff, would something this issue has come up before on the podcast. And so I don't, is a vehicle, if a subcontractor uses their own vehicle and submits expenses for, reimburse, like maybe it's mileage reimbursement, maybe it's repairs on the vehicle because it's such a big part of what they do for the organization, would that sort of go into this? That's probably more of an employee versus subcontractor, or is that a completely different issue?
So I think it depends on, and it feels like I'm splitting hairs, but I think this is where the analysis would go, is it depends on who owns the vehicle. So if it's a subcontractor that's using their own vehicle and they're submitting for reimbursement, to me, that is their tool. They are bringing their tool to the job and completing the job as it's assigned, using their own tools. Just because they're getting reimbursed for mileage or gas or repairs and maintenance doesn't necessarily torpedo that. You know, if the organization is providing a vehicle and having someone drive it, and we're going to ignore for the fact like the liability and all of that stuff that is giving me an ulcer, even in the example that we're talking about. I think it's that needle again. So if the worker is bringing their own vehicle and they're submitting for repairs and maintenance and mileage reimbursement, kind of nudges the needle a little bit further in favor of an independent contractor. If the organization is providing the vehicle, and especially if the vehicle's, wrapped with the organization's logos and things like that, it kind of nudges it more in favor of an employee.
Okay. Okay. And I know there's a lot of, like you said, splitting hairs. There's probably a million examples we all could throw out there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
You have probably heard them all. So do you have, other than doing it the right way and a way that protects the organization, and do you have any advice for those who are listening to this going, oh my gosh, I think I have several independent contractors that are misclassified. Where do I begin? Especially if it's maybe their first. We have listeners all over the country, actually even in different countries. And so we have people coming from a lot of different probably laws and regulations, both statewide. I mean, there's the federal, but then there's also looking at their state law to know exactly how it's classified. So a few questions. One, does federal always, are federal and state in sync, or does one supersede the other related to classification issues?
Boy, that's a loaded one. And I was going to try so hard not to say this, because the typical lawyer answered that it depends. So there's, in employee classification or worker classification issues, it's kind of a twofer or a double whammy. From a state and federal level, because there may be a state law that allows you to, like here in Nevada, for example, if anybody was paying close attention to the fight, the knockdown dragout fight that like Uber and Lyft had, that we're waging here to say, okay, we are a technology company, we're not a transportation company, therefore we don't need to be subject to the Nevada Department of Transportation or the Nevada Transportation Authority. And, you know, these drivers are not employees, they're independent contractors. And so they did manage to change some of the statute, which makes Nevada, like the state law in Nevada, a little bit different from federal law. And then of course makes state law in Nevada different from California. And I think they're still waging those wars. The states are really trying to figure out a way to get payroll taxes for all of these, you know, probably hundreds of thousands of rideshare drivers. So it's a constantly changing landscape. As far as like, if you're listening to this and you have a little bit of the, pardon the expression, the pucker factor, because you think that you've been not necessarily doing this properly, you can hire, there are, you know, HR consultants, you can hire an attorney, although that may be a little bit like a trying to kill a gnat with a sledgehammer. If you're in the state of Nevada, and I don't know if there's analogous organizations across the country, hopefully there are. If you're an organization in Nevada, I cannot recommend highly enough, whether you're a nonprofit or a for-profit or any organization, to join the Nevada Association of Employers. And what it is an organization, it's a membership-based organization, it's based on employee headcount. And they have on staff both licensed employment, specialized employment lawyers, as well as SHRM, which is Society for Human Resources Management.
Yep.
Certified. I mean, they have certifications out the wazoo, and they help organizations with exactly these questions. That is not at an attorney's, you know, hourly rate. They have been not only an immense help and such a great resource to my clients, but also to me personally. I cannot recommend them enough. They're this like weird secret in Nevada. So I would strongly recommend reaching out. The rep I know, there's Amy Matthews. The guy who's the head of the organization used to be the labor commissioner. So they know what they're talking about.
Oh,
and I would
great.
Strongly recommend. And then if you do have an organization, if your organization is large enough to have an in-house HR person, they have an annual conference that has been in Reno the last couple of years that I've attended, just rich with. And so the needle conversation is a presentation that I attended with the Nevada Association of Employers. So if you're not in Nevada, look and see if there is some sort of employer organization that helps with that. You may even be able to reach out to the Nevada Association of Employers and ask them if there's something similar in their state, because I would strongly suspect that they know who else is out around the country.
That's great. And so, and they will, it sounds like from what you're saying, organizations like them can potentially help someone of any size. It could be an organization hiring their first employee or their 100th employee, correct? Like Okay.
And they counsel, because employment law, and even, so I'm a, you know, kind of general business, generalist, you know, practitioner. We kind of serve as general counsel, outside general counsel to businesses. Employment law is so very specific and changes so frequently, both at the state level and the federal level. Every legislative session, there is some sort of bill that's coming through trying to change the employment law. So even though we bump up against it at my firm, I do not consider myself an employment lawyer, and I do not hold myself out that way because it is so fussy. And so I rely on, you know, because they are keeping abreast of all of those different changes, and they will counsel people through. Like, I had coffee with Amy, the person I was talking about. She was like, oh, I got to go. She was helping train and then onboard a new CFO for one of their clients. I was like, wow. You guys do that? And then, you know, later that afternoon, somebody called and they needed to terminate an employee. And so they will walk you through the proper way so you don't step in anything as you're terminating employee. I mean, I can't say good enough things.
What a wonderful resource. And I hope for those listening, we're going to put all of this in the show notes with all the links. We're also going to put, Gina, the link to your article that you mentioned at the beginning, the blog post, and anything else, if you have anything else you want us to share. This is just a wealth of knowledge info. I feel like, gosh, what's your hourly rate? I owe you a really big lunch for doing this.
Don't worry about it. I'm honored.
Well, thank you. And just thank you always for being a loyal supporter of the podcast, coming on in the past as we've grown. It's been fun. We actually have, I don't think I shared it with you, and our listeners can hear too. I mean, we're starting to get inquiries. We've gotten a couple from Canada and from ones back east. So it's grown to a point where nonprofits, you know, we started in more of the Nevada base and it's expanded. So it's been pretty exciting. But I think for anyone listening, yes, thank you. You have resources. Anyone listening, there should be resources like this in every state. So it's just a matter of finding them, or finding your own Gina in your community who can point you to those resources. So great. Gina, thank you so much. Anything else? Any parting words before we sign off?
Of course, no. I'm sorry that I rambled so much. I was hoping to get to more questions. But if you need me again in the future, I'd be happy to come back on and try to tackle some burning questions that your listeners have.
Well, we so appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, thanks for listening to another episode of Nonprofit Everything. We appreciate that you've taken the time out of your day to listen to the podcast. If you enjoyed this, please share it. If you didn't, let us know. Let us know what we can do better. Stacy and I really do appreciate the feedback. Please send us your questions. Please share this with friends. Go ahead and rate us on all of the rating places, which helps us expand the reach and get more questions coming in from other people. Thanks a lot. We really appreciate you, and we will see you in a couple of weeks.